So, as Mary said, I'm the executive director of the Build Healthy Places Network, but I'm also a pediatrician and a public health professor at UC Berkeley. And one of the things she asked me to talk a little bit about was how I ended up here on a panel with a Federal Reserve official and a community developer. And as some of you may know, if you're in clinical medicine, I had finished all my medical school and residency, and what I've told my niece and nephew is that I was in 23rd grade when I went out to work in the clinic, and I worked in East Palo Alto in California, which is one of the poorest neighborhoods in the Bay Area, and was more than a little shocked that 23 years of education had basically not prepared me for what I was really going to see in the clinic. I could do a great job of screening them for anemia or lead levels. I could get them the vaccinations, but a lot of what was facing them were things I just hadn't learned much about. And I took what I thought was going to be a one-year leave of absence to do a public health degree at Berkeley. And now, what, 12 years later, here I am. I did, in fact, do a fellowship through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It's called the Health and Society Scholars Program, which was really focusing on population health and social determinants of health, which, again, is kind of funny to me that, as a physician, those weren't terms I understood at the time. And I think we're getting better at that, but we've got a ways to go. It was around that time then that I had the great fortune to meet David Erickson and Nancy Andrews, both of whom happened to be here, and really it was working with them and really beginning to recognize the importance of this community development sector that I didn't really understand, and the excitement I saw about the ability. The way we sometimes have said is that in public health I found that we were often studying poverty, but not necessarily knowing what to do about it or how to actually change neighborhoods. And so it was a bit of a surprise to me that there's a whole developed sector that does exactly that. And not on a small scale, and we'll get to this, but it's about $150 billion a year, with a B, billion dollars a year, invested into low-income communities in exactly the types of upstream neighborhood building infrastructure that is an important part, at least, of what we need to do to get families into better shape. So one of the things that we've had the opportunity to do, so the Build Healthy Places Network is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and one of the things that we were able to get in the grant was money to put together a video that describes this. So I think we'll just go straight to that.
Thank you.
that was fun to make. And we've joked that my parents actually know what I do now for the first time in about 15 years. I'll add, too, that we had a launch event last night at the Refresh Project that you just saw in the video, and it's really striking. I mean, it's a grocery store. It was one of the largest parcels, what they call derelict parcels, in the city of New Orleans. It was an abandoned warehouse, and now it's a grocery store. There's a Tulane, what they call it, the Institute of Culinary Medicine is based there, and there's also something called, what's this?
Liberty's Kitchen,
where they actually bring in local teens and young adults to teach them how to cook, and they make lunches for the local schools. So it's really a multi-purpose facility, and exactly the kind of thing that we'll hear a little bit more about from David and Nancy. So many of you have probably heard the idea that your zip code is more important than your genetic code in determining your health and life chances, and this is actually the zip code for, I think, where we're sitting right now. One way that you can think about it is that community development is in the zip code improvement business, and that for me was a big shock that there was a group of professionals whose focus is not on the periphery, but actual focus is investing money and resources into low-income neighborhoods. And this is actually the part of the Neighborhood Centers, Inc. in Houston, and this is the poorest neighborhood in Houston. It's the Galton Sharpstown neighborhood, and this was a community facility put in. And in fact, they specifically didn't put a big fence or any security around. They said the neighborhood's going to be the security. It's been there 5 years now. It still looks just like this. So it is sort of a reminder that that can happen. Oh, please.
So that, just for that picture again, we were giving a presentation on this, and somebody who had worked at the F2AC that lived there was saying she used to park 200 feet from the front door, and she needed an armed guard to escort her from her car to the clinic. And now what you see in that photograph is this place that has no security at all and almost no crime problems. Mm-hmm.
And I'll add, too, for the academics and others in the room, you saw the statistic about the school, for example, the graduation rate going from 30% to 78%. That's among the kids who are on free and reduced lunches. So although it is a mixed-income community, those are the same kids. It's now the highest-performing elementary school in the Atlanta metro area, even though it's got an 80% free and reduced lunch rate. So they're performing better than some of the wealthiest schools. So just to, I think for me at least, and perhaps for some of you, this is what I had thought of when I thought of community development. Although the term, community development really did come out of the war on poverty, we said, but urban renewal was a term that was used for a long time, and this is St. Louis. This did not last very long for lots of reasons. But I want to highlight that this industry really has learned a lot over the last several decades. So this is really what you see now. So it's very integrated with the community, supportive housing, affordable housing. That's low-income housing in the lower left. It takes the sun and turns it into energy and puts it into the grid, so no one has to pay utility bills, which is kind of amazing. Small businesses, charter schools. So these are some of the sorts of things that are being built. And again, so just a couple comments and I'll close, is I mentioned the $150 billion a year. One of the things that's, I think, important to me, or what struck me when I learned this, was that this is happening with or without the input of public health. These investments are going on every year. And I think there's an opportunity to, in addition to participate with the way these are being run, to also study the impact of these types of investments, because we don't entirely know in public health or medicine what are the best investments. Well, the investments are happening, so we can't get a multi-billion dollar grant from the NIH, but we can work with people who already have those sorts of resources. So I think there are opportunities there that we're not fully engaged in. Another thing that came up when I first really learned about this industry is there was a emphasis on outputs rather than outcomes. So for example, it was the number of housing units built was a measure of success, not perhaps were the lives of the people in those housing units better, which is in fact the focus of community development. It's much like in clinical medicine. It's the number of patients you've seen, not necessarily whether they all got better. We are trying in medicine and public health to improve our measures as we are in community development. What else do I have here? this issue of integration. Now, the Refresh project we talked about, those examples I showed you are really some of the ideal examples of integrated community development investments, where they're really working across sectors and have a more powerful impact. Those are very hard to finance, which is one of the things that we're trying to support, is how do we better finance these? There's a history of really plunking down housing where the opportunity arose, and some of that is why the sort of the old style of community development wasn't working, and that's really a big shift. There's also this issue of anecdote. So one of the goals of the network is to really reduce the anecdotal nature of this type of work. There are successes across the country, and we shouldn't be discovering them sitting right here and hearing about purpose-built communities for the first time. It is an amazing model that everybody should learn about. And we need to fix that. And the last is really this health return on investment. That really one of the things that struck me was the community development sector was investing a lot of money, but their return on investment was largely evaluated not considering health as part of that. And we now know with the ACA changes and whatnot that this type of work is really creating a return on investment that could be included and really make the financial model much stronger. So I'll just say quickly, I mean, the role for the network is really going to be connecting these audiences across sectors, providing access to the research, best practices, models, demonstrating what works, highlighting the value of health and how that can be used for finance, and there's going to be a real focus on measurement and metrics. How do we properly measure? And that's another role, I think, for public health, is that I think we measure disease and the lack of disease, but do we really measure the presence of health and well-being? That's something that they really need us to do more effectively, and I think there are a lot of good ideas out there, but we need to do some work on that. So with that, the network's vision is communities where all people can live rewarding and healthy lives, and please join us on the network and take a look. Let us know what we can do to make this really valuable and effective to all of you, because that's our goal over the coming years. So thank you very much.